Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Will Baptiste of the musical duo Black Violin. But first, North Dakota is known for being sparsely populated, cold much of the year, and for a landscape that many consider to be desolate. But part of the state was radically transformed starting in 2006 with the discovery of extensive oil reserves in the Bakken Formation. Coupled with fracking technology that made it possible to collect that oil, suddenly North Dakota was a land of opportunity, and people flocked there from all over the country. Journalist Maya Rao decided to study the oil boom from the inside. She lived and worked in North Dakota and has published her experiences in the new book, Great American Outpost, Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier. She'll be reading tonight at 7 p.m. at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City, and she is here with me now. Hello, Maya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And take us back to 2006, 2007, the start of this oil boom. For those of us who maybe weren't following what was going on in North Dakota at that time, tell me about the discovery of this oil reserve in the Bakken Formation and what it meant.
Sure. So North Dakota first discovered oil in the 1950s. They always knew it was there. They had another boom in the 80s, but oil was never very easy to extract profitably. Advances in fracking and horizontal drilling helped with the discovery of the Bakken Shale about a dozen years ago, and $100 a barrel oil prices also helped spur along this major oil boom. Suddenly, this area where it had been very difficult to get the oil out, now it was possible. It was making people a lot of money. And so people rushed in from all over the country and from all over the world. At first, it was, landmen and big oil companies, then laborers, investors, pipeliners, truck drivers. So this was an area that was just really remote. There was nothing there. There was no infrastructure. So, they were just totally unprepared for that. So in my book, I look at how I try to cover the broader arc of it and how some of these dynamics and decisions that came from earlier in the boom played out after things fell off a couple years ago when there became a big oversupply of oil globally.
Well, and let's talk about this area prior to the boom. As I mentioned, sparsely populated, pretty desolate landscape, really chilly climate. How many people were there before?
In the state overall, I think it was somewhere in the 600,000s, and they had been losing population since the Great Depression. And even as recently as the early 2000s, they were so desperate to lure new blood, they started in Western North Dakota a website called prairieopportunity.com to lure in new people and try to convince them that small town life would make it worth their while to move to this really cold, remote area. So it was not very successful. And then with the discovery of the Bakken a couple years later, they found they were getting way more people than they had ever wanted.
Well, and of course, let's all remember 2006, 2007. Economically, the rest of the country was not doing well. I mean, that's about when the housing bubble burst. And things were, spiraling downward economically in many places. So that just heightened this boom, right?
Right. A lot of people rushed in who had lost their jobs elsewhere. Some were from a blue-collar background. Some were from a white-collar background. I mean, some of the investors that came there had gone bankrupt or they had their own problems during the financial crisis. So it was people of all kinds. And as there was this housing bust elsewhere in the U.S., in the Bakken, that became a place where the community was desperate for people to build housing, to make those investments. So we saw yet another building bubble start to take hold there.
Now, as this boom really took hold, there were journalists covering it. We were hearing stories on public radio and all over the place. When did you first get interested in what was going on there?
Well, I made my first trip there in 2012, and I was living in Minneapolis at the time. And so I was sort of following it. But you're right, there were a lot of other reporters there. So I sort of held back a little bit. But then in 2014, I started to focus a lot more. And that was a really interesting time because they seemed like they were starting to get a handle on everything. They were building enough. It was sort of stabilizing. But then, just as it seemed like everything was going pretty well, things went off a cliff there. And that's what a lot of the book looks at as well. When OPEC sort of declared this oil price war against the U.S. shale industry and oil prices crashed, there was a lot of tension there between people wanting to leave and yet investors and community members having interest in having people stay there.
What were you not seeing or reading or hearing in other coverage that made you think, I could tell this story better, that I need to get there and get to know these people?
Sure. Well, one of the things I thought was missing was just, being able to read about something that was happening in a more of an organic and firsthand way. It was pretty common to see, news reporters didn't have a lot of time there. They'd have to parachute in and out. So they would quote the police chief saying there's a lot of crime, or they'd quote someone saying something's happening here or it's really crazy here. But it wasn't being told sort of in the way I would have wanted to do it, which is just narrative nonfiction, combining a lot of your own observations and telling the story more naturally. So in my book, I don't really have any police chief saying there's a lot of crime, but you get the sense that there certainly is based on some of the characters that pop up.
Absolutely. So when you decided to go there to tell this story, did you already think, I'm going to write a book about this?
Yeah, I always had an inkling that there was a book there, but I wasn't quite sure exactly at first what it would be. I didn't want to just recite the basic facts. People already do have a lot of that at their disposal. So I wanted to find interesting characters and interesting dispatches. So I started that process by working at a truck stop called the Wild Bison, and I was a cashier there for a while, making $14 an hour.
And, which is a pretty good wage for hourly work. And yes. I mean, that was probably twice what you would have made at a truck stop. Not that you were working at a truck stop in Minnesota, but
yeah,
that gives us a little bit of insight already into how just economically they're operating on a different level there.
Right, right. And, a lot of the truck stop employees were living in campers down the road, and coming in the truck stop in the morning before their shift to shower and starting the shift with wet hair. It wasn't exactly a dream scenario to just make $14 an hour there.
Well, and when you got that job, even just getting offered the job gave you a little bit of insight into the culture. Tell me about that.
Sure. So, on my application, I don't think I said I worked for the Star Tribune, but I put the last couple papers I worked at. And, I put my my other cashiering job from 2002 working at Target for $7 an hour back then, by the way. But yeah, they were really eager for help. Like a lot of retail establishments there, they had this huge turnover in staff. People were cycling in and out, and especially the men. As soon as they could find a higher paying job in an oil field, they would run for that. So they just offered me the job on the spot, really. And that was great for me. And when I left there after a month, normally that would be considered bad form to leave a job after a month. But out in the oil field, I mean, nobody was surprised. Nobody was angry. They kind of understand that's just how it works out there.
So from the vantage point of a cashier, you had the opportunity to get to know some of the people who had traveled to the oil fields and lived in the area in a unique way. Tell me a little bit about truck stop culture in the Bakken.
Yeah, so truck stops there are really these mini economic hubs. That's where a lot of life centers on. I mean, people come there. That's where people get their food. Sometimes that's where people get their Thanksgiving dinner. That's where everyone gets their chewing tobacco.
You had to learn a lot about different kinds of yes. chewing tobacco really fast.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of oil workers are laboring in a lot of isolation, especially if they're not working on a crew, but if they're driving a truck or certain other kinds of jobs, they can be very isolated. So sometimes for them to talk with the cashier or catch up with some acquaintances at a truck stop, it might be their only social interaction for a couple days. But the main guy that I follow in my book, he was a truck driver I met there named Danny, and he had come from North Carolina. And so he took me out in the truck one day while he was hauling fresh water to a frack site. And he talked to me about how when he got to the oil field, he barely knew how to drive. You know, he had a CDL, a commercial driver's license, but he had just graduated trucking school. He had no practical experience.
And you write that his trucking school was pretty suspect and had yes. a lot of bad reviews anyway.
Right, right. I mean, he was one of a lot of people, especially from the South, that came up and they were just sort of winging it. So he fumbled around. He's a pretty smart guy, so he eventually found his way. But, you know, he's always told me that, you know, I'm lucky that I didn't die during that time. Because so many people died on those roads. A lot of North Dakotans know somebody who died in a fatality there because the semi-truck came through and flipped over. The roads were just not meant for all these 18-wheelers.
So, yeah, paint that picture a little more for us, because, I mean, there were so many deaths on, in particular, this one roadway, right?
Highway 85, yeah. So Highway 85 definitely comes up throughout the book. It's a sort of a character of its own, in a way. And I remember, like a lot of people out there, that the highway used to be just two lanes, and it would be bumper to bumper. You'd get flying rocks that crack your windshield. I was late to a couple of appointments and a couple shifts at the truck stop because I didn't understand that even to drive a short distance on that road, you have to sort of double the normal time.
Wow. Well, we'll talk more about that in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. With me this hour is Maya Rao. She's now a Washington correspondent for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. She is the author of the new book, Great American Outpost, Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier, writing about the oil boom in North Dakota. She'll be reading tonight at 7 p.m. at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Coming up later this hour, I'll talk with Will Baptiste of the musical duo Black Violin. They'll be performing in Cedar Falls this week. With me right now is journalist Maya Rao. She's just published the new book, Great American Outpost, Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier. It's about the oil boom in North Dakota. She'll be reading tonight at 7 p.m. at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. And Maya, you mentioned Danny, which is one of the people in the book that you profile. And you talk about why he came to North Dakota, left, came back. Tell us a little bit more about him, because I think he does give us a lot of insight into who was drawn to this culture.
Right. Well, it was important for me to profile a truck driver because trucking is the most common job out there. And yet there was always this fundamental tension there. When around the year that Danny got there, around 2012, the state regulators were really pushing hard to get as many pipelines in the ground as they could so that they didn't need to rely on these trucks, so that they could make things safer and more convenient and cut down on congestion, cut down on fatalities. And so Danny and I think a lot of the other ones didn't necessarily understand right away that the regulations were going to start working against them at some point. So I really followed him through that process. And later in the book, I get into more of the pipelines and how that worked. Another really notable thing about him that I thought was representative of a certain amount of people there was that it's a certain point, he was working in a lot of really brutal solitude. He was trucking in some of the most remote areas, probably in the country. He was on the Indian reservation for a while. And there was a lot of cultural clashes there with resenting some of this white encroachment. The Fort Berthold Indian Reservation at that time was, kind of frustrated that a lot of outside oil corporations had come in, that they didn't control that oil. So he was pulling oil for a variety of outside companies and kind of, I've been out with him on the Indian Reservation. It's very remote. And it sounds like, I mean, that can be really soul-crushing from talking to him and other people to just go, all you're doing day in and day out is just going from one oil site to another oil site. And, you know, this guy, he used to be a surfer. He likes the ocean. One of many Southerners, you know, that came up there. So for him to be out in this place that he sort of views as a barren, remote wasteland was just psychologically difficult, too.
But the draw of the money that he could make, I mean, that was enough to keep him there, although it sounds like it was in many places the last place he wanted to be.
Yeah, definitely money is a big part of that. And that's what he and many other people just really wrestled with. I mean, you know, feeling like there was not anywhere else to go or anything else to do, but not really wanting to be there either.
You mentioned the incredible danger on the roads, and you also paint a really stark picture about part of why it's so dangerous, because the way things were structured there when you arrived, there was every incentive for truckers to drive longer than they should have been driving, to drive heavier loads than they should have been driving, to drive in conditions that they shouldn't have been driving in. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people there were cutting corners, and it wasn't because they were bad people necessarily, but you know, sometimes the way the distances were set up and the pay was set up, I mean, they needed to just haul way overweight. So when your truck is overweight, it takes longer for the brakes to work. You're already on dangerous roads anyway. So that was definitely sort of frightening to learn how common that was. I mean, there's a lot of people there, you know, they might drink and drive or use drugs, or they're just really sleepy. You know, in other places, like on the over-the-road trucking, outside the oil field, they wouldn't be able to drive longer than 11 hours. But there's, I mean, you know, in some of these instances, these truckers are driving almost continuously in the oil field. Especially when the boom was at its busiest, there weren't many people who were checking. And that did change, though. When I was there in 2015, I saw cops everywhere. But the regulations always seemed to mismatch the timing of everything. By the time they got all those cops and regulators, some of the truck traffic had begun to fall off anyway.
You found that there were people like Danny who came looking for opportunity. There were family men who were sort of parachuting in to work for a month at a time and then flying home to be with their family, and, you know, that didn't have steady work but were coming in to make a living. You also found that there were a lot of people who, I guess, exist on the margins or had done things, had experiences in other places that made it very hard for them to be employed anywhere else. I mean, paint a little bit of that picture. There were some really shady things going on.
Yeah, there were. That's why I thought it was important to live there for a longer period, because that's sort of when you could peel that back. One example of that is there's a guy interviewing there who, I have a couple chapters on him, and he'd actually been interviewed by the media a lot before, because he was known for making all these interesting YouTube videos about life on the oil field. He had worked at Walmart, and, you know, he always painted that as, you know, I'm just coming for a better life, which was true. But after a number of interviews, he told me that he was actually a convicted sex offender, had gone to prison for that, and that, you know, it's hard, obviously, to find work as a sex offender or even to find places to live. And he, to my knowledge, he hadn't committed any crimes since then. But, you know, at some point, Walmart discovered that he claimed and they fired him. So that was just there. And there were a lot of people like that that had some sort of issue they were running from.
I can imagine you mentioned earlier how North Dakota had been trying to attract people to the state. And then there's this huge influx of people to the state. And they're not necessarily people who want to build a life there. They're people who just want to make money off of what's going on right now. How did that affect the locals?
Well, it was a really strange contrast because a lot of people in that part of North Dakota, they've had multiple generations living on one farm or running one business. They're very close-knit, you know, and they've been in one place forever. And then you get these people flying through who have totally opposite situations. So there's definitely this resentment, I think, especially, you know, of Southerners. And it wasn't just resentment of laborers. I mean, a lot of it was landmen or pipeline surveyors that often came from somewhere like Texas. A lot of the ranchers and farmers felt like they were very careless when they were on their land. They'd leave gates open so cattle would get out. They wouldn't remediate the land properly. They felt, I think one of the biggest casualties here was that North Dakotans had always been a trusting people. And a lot of them told me that this made them sort of become harsher and meaner and less trusting because they had to be. They didn't like that about themselves, but they felt like they were their trusting nature was being taken advantage of.
You were very vulnerable as a journalist, as a woman in this environment, trying to get close to people, going out in big rigs, you know. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you were in danger?
It depends, you know. I mean, I don't think I was out there during the worst of the period for women, but, you know, some of the things that scared me were about being on oil sites. You know, there are some scenes in the book when Danny's trying to show me that he was hauling crude and we're on top of these oil tanks, you know, and I write about how there's been federal scrutiny of how oil workers doing that can die of those poisonous fumes. And so that's something, you know, you can always work around people, but when you're thinking about toxic fumes, I mean, that's where I really get scared. Just trying to deal with some of those things was difficult. I wanted to get the scene, but I wanted to be safe as well. There was another time I remember being on a visiting an oil rig, and it was late at night because I wanted to watch it. It was one of those walking rigs where they move it over to the next well. And they can sort of, it's really fascinating to watch. But I was there and it was dark, and suddenly I see an explosion at what looks like the next site over, the next hill over. And it was apparently, they were saying, an exploding flare. And everyone was very casual about it. And I'm looking at that, thinking we're going to get
casual.
Blown up. You know, they were telling me, though, that I guess if you work on the oil field for a long time, you get a sense of what's dangerous and what's not. But I didn't have that context, at least not at first. So I was always dealing with that element of fear about sometimes how literally volatile some of these things seemed.
Right. I'm talking with Maya Rao. Her book is Great American Outpost, Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier, about the North Dakota oil boom. And so you've mentioned the pipeline, which of course everyone has heard now about the Bakken pipeline, about the Dakota Access Pipeline, and it's very, very controversial. I want to talk about it in terms of how that changes the industry, though. Politics aside, and how it impacts those whose land it crosses, how does that change the picture in North Dakota to have a pipeline?
Well, one of the reasons that the Bakken really needed that $100 oil was because it was so much more expensive to produce there. It's remote, it's colder. It doesn't have the same infrastructure as places like Texas. So to have this big pipeline, you know, makes it more cost efficient for the oil to be transported to refineries, and it takes those really scary oil trains off the tracks. So that's good. That's given the industry a certain level of confidence. But I was there in 2015 when, you know, the before this had really blown up on the national stage, but when land men were approaching a lot of the people in Western North Dakota to get easements, and there were people who were really frustrated because at that point the pipeline fatigue had reached a really high level. And often when in the book, when I write about pipelines, it's not these big pipelines that get national headlines. It's just a lot of the small gathering lines from an oil well to a rail station or from a saltwater depot to a saltwater tank. And, you know, a lot of the industry was working so hard to get those built that ranchers were complaining they were not remediating the land properly or they were just really sloppy. So people, by the time Dakota Access Pipeline came along, they were really resisting giving pipeline companies even more, even something bigger. But you know what? I remember one of the farmers told me that Dakota Access came in like the schoolyard bully from Texas. So you know, a lot of these pipeline companies were from Texas, and that's how you know a lot of those North Dakota locals, I mean, did resent Texas and Southerners in general. They felt like these people were just intruding and taking advantage of them, and then they weren't getting as much of the profits as these outsiders were.
The lack of infrastructure was part of what made it so profitable for people to go there. And of course, the oil prices falling, that changed the landscape dramatically too, but also building the infrastructure changed the landscape dramatically. So the last time you were there, what's it like? I mean, all of these things were being built. All of these people were coming. Have a lot of people just disappeared?
Yeah, this goes back to this issue of how there was such a fundamental mismatch of timing and then actually getting things built. So by 2015, they had built so many apartments and restaurants and saltwater disposals and pipelines, all kinds of things. And then a lot of people then were just losing their jobs and losing their income and were ready to leave. And so apartment developers were really desperate for tenants. You also saw a lot of trailers and frac tanks and junk was just abandoned in fields. And so there was, and because it had cost investors so much money to build there, they were reluctant to lower their rates and their rents enough to meet the new economic reality. So there was just kind of this long holding pattern where just a real tension. And the town there was a constant debate about whether in Williston, you know, whether they should have really built so much apartments or whether they should have kind of accepted that there was some element of a temporary and transient nature to this.
What do you want people to take away from your book, from getting a better understanding of this boom? And I'm reluctant to call it a bust because it's not entirely a bust. I mean, this is still a going concern, and it's still, there are many people employed in oil production in North Dakota right now. So maybe a boom and a leveling off. But what do you want people to understand about this?
I want people to look at this as just this microcosm of capitalism and industrialization in 21st century America, in a place that very few people get to see, and how there's a lot of elements of history repeating itself. And throughout the book, I weave in some of the history of past gold rushes. And you can see there's kind of this, it is an American story, but it's also kind of a timeless human story. And it says something bigger about the economic cycles that we keep finding ourselves in.
You also, in the last chapter of the book, you juxtapose your experience and what's going on in this area with the 2016 presidential elections. And you write about how some of the political rhetoric was jarring to you after being where you were. Tell me more about that.
Sure. So, you know, everyone that I met in the oil field was fairly conservative. They were Republican. And we were just in this area where free enterprise was
running rampant.
Yes. Yes. And people just casually talked about capitalism all the time. So I came back and my editors at the Star Tribune just temporarily moved me to help cover the State House in St. Paul, Minnesota. And, you know, the governor was pretty liberal, Governor Dayton. So it's just really weird sometimes listening to some of these politicians. They're like, I had to cover some of Bernie Sanders' rallies in Minnesota. And I felt this really strange political whiplash.
So what now, of course, there's this push among journalists and you're in D.C. And people are saying, oh, wait, we didn't know anything about Middle America. Now we need to learn about Middle America. So what can we take away from your experience in North Dakota that really gives us some insight into what's going on in the United States right now?
Well, you know, I grew up on the East Coast, and so I get where those journalists are coming from. But I think it's just really, I have to go back to this idea that it's really hard to parachute in. I think you have to live there. And it took me a long time to feel like I understood the Midwest and understood North Dakota in particular. So, I mean, I know that it's so popular to have bureaus in foreign areas, but I would love to just see bureaus in Middle America.
To talk to people, get to know people, and understand them as humans.
Yeah, in a more organic way.
Well, Maya, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Maya Rao, her book is Great American Outposts, Dreamers, Mavericks, and the Making of an Oil Frontier. She'll be reading tonight at 7 p.m. at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Will Baptiste of the musical duo Black Violin. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.